talk of the Northwest. The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. It is 3 minutes past nine on this Tuesday, the 10th of February, 2026. You're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show, and it's another bumper effort for you. We've got Community Garlic information coming up for you after 10, where we bring you the very latest news, information and appeals from Ancarta Síochána first here on the Greg Hughes Show, and loads more besides. If you want to talk about anything or comment on what we've got lined up for you, 086 60 25000, that's your WhatsApp and your text number. Feel free to give us a call on 07491 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. and if you're listening to the podcast, which is available for you not only on our website but also on Spotify, so you can like and subscribe, it's greatly appreciated if you did. Well, feel free to comment, send in your WhatsApps or your emails, we'll pick them up and carry them over to the next live show. How's about that? Right, okay, let's look at the newspapers. And a lot of talk of rent about, and unfortunately, new rules to be introduced by government could send rents through the roof. Rents for new tenants could be more than 5,000 a year. Could rise by more than 5,000 a year under new rules that will allow landlords to reset rents to full market rates. Under the Residential Tenancies Bill 2026, landlords will be able to reset rents to full market levels for any new tenancy, providing the previous tenant left of their own accord and was not subjected to a no-fault eviction. The measure is scheduled to take effect on March 1st, alongside a separate reform that will introduce a minimum tenancy duration of 6 years. Analysis by Sinn Féin of figures from the Residential Tenancies Board, rent index indicates the national average rent for existing tenancies is 1,482 and 1,731 for new tenancies. If these rents are reset to the market rate, meaning the rate for new tenants, this would represent an increase of €249 per month, or €2,988 a year. Now, in Donegal, what figures from RTB predict reforms will do to rents, new tenants only? County by county breakdown shows average monthly rents and predicted annual rise. The average rent in Donegal at the moment is €1,021. Now, of course, you're going to say, well, it's €1,400 here, it's €15 there, it's €16 here, it's €9 there. That's the average. But that will mean that rent in this county, when reset, would go up by almost €2,000, which is an awful lot. And there's other stuff in the papers today which will point to the fact that we can't really afford that, the cost of living and all that type of stuff. So under the new rent rules, if you are a new tenant moving into a private rental property, you can expect for it to cost you, compared to today, an extra €2,000 per year. We'll talk about more about that a little later on. But there's only so many pressures that we can put up with. You know, we in this country, this is not an opinion or anti anything, but the reality is we have two very different existences here in the Republic of Ireland. Where the decisions are made in Dublin, there is a massive level of disposable income compared to what we have up here. There's just absolutely no doubt about that. So the amount of money that we have left over to live on in this county is far, 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 far below that of Dublin. Add into that 20% of TDs and senators and landlords, and it kind of starts feeling a little bit like them against us for some people, I'm sure. But anyway, I'll tease out some more of the figures in relation to the difference between, say, Donegal and Dublin in terms of the disposable income a little later on in the programme. I have them recorded. But anyway, the point being, the increases might be more absorbable if you've got more disposable income. But we're at the pin of our collar here. So every time food goes up, every time petrol and diesel goes up, every time power goes up, every time our rent goes up, what's happening is it's eating into our smaller reserve from our incomes. You know, and that is very, very problematic. The legal workers aren't doing too bad. The Irish Daily Mail tells us that three defence lawyers earned almost €1 million each through criminal legal aid payments last year, as the bill for the state-funded scheme surged by 37% to a record 115.3 million. New figures provided by the Department of Justice show that payouts to solicitors and barristers under the Criminal Legal Aid Scheme jumped from 84.08 million in 2024 to 115.3 million in 2025, a rise of 31.2 million in 1 year. Michael Bowman was the best paid senior counsel in the country through Criminal Legal Aid, receiving 961,000 plus change. Dublin solicitor Michael Hennessy retained his position as the best paid Criminal Legal Aid solicitor, receiving just over 971,000. And Keith Spencer was the best paid junior counsel. He just received 972,000. The one thing I've noticed from court's reports is that the majority of people seem to get free legal aid. And everyone's entitled to a defence, I believe. But where's the clawback? Like, is it time that we had that conversation again about how we claw some of this back? Maybe it might be for those who are repeat offenders. Maybe it might make them think again if their income into the future was to be docked to pay some of this money back. Because the way it is at the moment, it is a free-for-all. The solicitors making a fortune, but they are there to defend people, I suppose. But as I say, it seems that 9 times out of 10, or maybe I'm misreading the figures, it seems 9 times out of 10, an application is made for free legal aid, and that is granted. And it's at a great expense to the regular taxpayer. Big problems in Britain for Keir Starmer, but it looks like he might survive this latest controversy. He had 2 very senior members of his staff that left yesterday, and it looks like, given the outpouring of love for him from ministers on social media, that he might survive this controversy. But anyway, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer was engaged in a desperate rearguard action to save his premiership last night following an extraordinary day in Westminster when one of his biggest allies turned on him. Starmer, whose position is in peril over his disastrous appointment of Peter Mandelson as US ambassador, met Labour MPs in a room off the House of Commons, famous committee corridor last night to plead for their backing. The meeting came hours after a coordinated round of public endorsements from his cabinet, who all backed him online with similar statements. The intervention was arranged to counter a simultaneous announcement in Glasgow from Anas Souvoir, the leader of the Scottish Labour and previously an ally of Starmer's, who called on him to go. Now, the problem for Labour in Scotland, what they're worried about is there's upcoming elections and they could face a wipeout. So really, I think they're trying to protect their own jobs as much as turn on Starmer in that regard, though Starmer has an awful lot to be turned on. But anyway, it looks like he will survive. So I mentioned earlier on about a £2,000-plus increase in the cost of rent per annum in Donegal. And I talked of, you know, the layers and layers of increased costs. And Irish households are forking out €3,000 more every year for groceries than they were before the cost of living crisis, according to shock new data. Supermarket prices are climbing at their fastest rate in more than 2 years, with inflation nearly 7% higher than 12 months ago. Retail analyst World Panel said grocery inflation rose to 6.8% in the 12 weeks to the end of last month, compared to 8.25% a month earlier. While the current rate is considerably lower than the 17% that was recorded at the height of the cost of living crisis in the summer of 2023, the latest increases are on top of the earlier hikes. So you would know that. You know that, don't you? I mean, the price of meat, the price of everything, that weekly shop has just become so much more expensive. And there's people aren't doing weekly shops. They're literally living from day to day. But when we talk about inflation being down, it's very important to note that that still is increases. So if something, you know, so they might say, well, inflation is down to 5%. You go, oh, right, well, it was 17%. But prices are still going up by that 5%. But in this case, it's 8 or 9%. And as I say, we here in the Northwest and border counties in general, we have less money and we have less capacity to absorb these increases. And that's why you're seeing the likes of St. Vincent de Paul under so much pressure, even from people who are employed. Part of a commercial court case has been settled regarding a dispute over the distribution of insurance payouts to apartment owners in Chrysler. Four men, three women and three children, ranging in ages from 5 to 59, died in the explosion on October 7th, 2022. Now, the court heard yesterday the case involved apartment owners at the site of the Apple Green service station. The property is owned by Vivo Shell Limited, which developed the property and owned three of the 16 apartments. It was insured by Aviva Insurance Ireland Limited. Aviva sued Vivo Shell, plus several of the other apartment owners who are couples and individuals. Aviva said the insurance policy issued to Vivo Shell in 2022 meant the buildings were insured for 17 million and contents at 65,000. The amount for public liability for any one event was 6.5 million. Aviva said while the policy makes no express reference to the apartment owners as having any entitlement under the policy since the explosion, they have asserted they have certain other entitlements under insurance policy. Aviva said Vivo Shell appears to acknowledge the apartment owners have an entitlement under the building sum insured, but there has been no agreement on how the proportion should be divided. Aviva had no objection to the recognition of the right of apartment owners to a share in the building insurance and noted the clear difference over contents insurance. Andrew Fitzpatrick, senior counsel for Aviva, told Mr. Justice Mark Sanfrey yesterday they had been agreement between the parties and settlement could be handed into court over, including over the contents insurance. He said Vivo Shell contends a greater sum is payable under public liability insurance, which is disputed by Aviva, but the apartment owners do not want to get involved in that. It had been agreed the issue is still to be litigated between Aviva and Vivo Shell, while the apartment owners will get the benefit of the outcome. He said apartment owners will be entitled to apply to court for any orders necessary, and he sought an order striking out the case against the apartment owners with liberty for them to re-enter the case to apply for any such orders. Mr. Justice Sanfrey agreed to the orders and adjourned the balance of the action until May. And finally, it's good to see, albeit small, the cancer flights controversy getting some national coverage in the Irish Daily Star. Changes to a public service air route are down to people in Dublin making decisions that have no idea what it's like living in Donegal. It comes amid concerns that a changed timetable for the PSO route between Donegal and Dublin will cut off a medical lifeline for cancer patients. And just wanted to reference that being mentioned in the papers today. That fight continues, of course, and it will not go away anytime soon. Now we're joined on the programme by Sinead. Hi, Sinead.
Hi, Greg.
Thanks so much for chatting to us. It's a warning for others, really, because unfortunately you were targeted by a social media scam. Tell us what happened.
So basically, I had a very expensive watch and I put it up for sale on Facebook Marketplace, and this guy had contacted me several times about the watch and meeting up to view it. So by the second night, I had agreed to go over. He wanted to meet in Lifford because I'm from Strabane. So he wanted to meet in Lifford to view the watch. So I went across with a friend, and he was there. He was standing out waiting. He wasn't in a vehicle or anything. And I rolled the window down and I asked his name, and he gave me his name. And I'd asked him his age because he appeared very young. And he told me he was 17. Mm. And he says, do you mind if I get under the car and view? So I did. I was nervous, to be fair. And I said to my friend, lock that door, because I thought he's going to grab this watch and run. But so I got in and he went through the watch and went through all the paperwork and the authenticity of it and that. And then his daddy rung. His daddy phoned on the phone to say, what's going on? And he named him. Well, it was a fake name. Now we know that. And he says, yeah, Dad, it's all legit. It's definitely a good watch. And he goes, okay, do the transfer. So he brought up, and now looking back, I should have known. He had two phones. So I brought out another phone and he done it on a banking app that appeared to be from the Bank of Ireland. And it was an international transfer. And he says to me, can you spell your name and put it in there? So I put it in along with account number and sort code. And we done the transfer, he done the conversion, and it all went through in sterling through to my account, or so it seemed. And at the bottom it says this transaction may take 24 hours to clear for international reasons. And then below that it says, in red banner, this transaction cannot be cancelled. But when I checked my app, then there was no money in, and it didn't sit well with me, so I contacted my bank, and I told them I was sitting waiting for this transaction. Did it show anything pending? They said no, there was nothing pending, but that it wouldn't be unusual for an international transfer to take up to 24 hours, maybe up longer. So I was advised, you know, if there's cash in the account, if maybe it's an electronic transfer or a checking account, they can pull that transaction back. But if there was cash in the account, then that was probably good enough to go. And I asked the wee boy, I said, can I see your account? You've got my details. Can I see your account? And he showed me the account, and it showed €13,338 in his account. Mm. So I thought, right, OK. So I went on and on, and when the money didn't hit my account. And then the daddy started ringing back, and then the mummy started ringing, and I started getting, you know, God, you know, this is getting me. I was getting nervous then. I thought, just to be clear, genuine enough.
Yeah. So had they? So whilst he was sitting in the car with you, and you were like, okay, I'm in a position here now because I've watched him transfer this money, but something doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. At that point, was mm-hmm. his phone going off and his parents, in inverted commas, were calling him whilst he was still in the car?
Yes. Right, they were calling him to say what's going on. And then he put them on the phone to me, and they were angry in a sense. He says, he's transferred you that money, now give him the watch. And I said, but I haven't received the money. Mm. And you can understand why I'm apprehensive to give him the watch. And he says, well, it's a good enough. You knew that a transfer would take up to 24 hours. And I said, no, I didn't actually. I wasn't aware of this, but I kept going and going. And the wee boy was genuine enough. He was lovely. He seemed to appear lovely, and he definitely did charm. He was just charming. And I said to my friend, he said, this watch is not leaving this car. It's not going. And I said, look, I have a good feeling about this. I think it's, and I know now, in hindsight, I was too trusting and just give the wee boy the benefit of the doubt, even though he came from a different type of community. I thought, right, okay, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. And I said to him, I just took a picture of him. I said, I'm taking your picture, because if this isn't legit, I'm actually going to the police for this, and I'm going to put it over social media. And then I still give him the benefit of the doubt till yesterday. And then when I contacted the bank, they says you've been scammed. So for that reason, then I did. I shared it. And within 5 minutes, I've had over 24 messages of his real name and his very address. And I'm with the police today at 3 o'clock now for an interview on that as well.
So was it the loss of the watch, or you inputted your banking details as well? So was any money taken from your bank, or is your loss the loss of the watch at this point?
The value of the watch, the £1,100 watch, he got that, yeah. But as I say, a friend of mine rang me yesterday, and he also got £8,000 of his friend 2 days ago. So it's basically this app. This is what people need to watch out for if they are going to be doing transfers. It's a fake app that looks so legitimate. Mm. It looks so real, and it definitely convinced me. And if I get a bit of awareness out for that, then somebody else will not be caught by him.
And they even stuck in the red banner saying, this can't be reversed.
The red banner to say this,
Okay. Mm-hmm. I know what you're... It's a multi-layered scam, because the pressure being applied externally from the older parents, in inverted commas, we don't know the actual relationship, and the vulnerable young lad in the car, you know, there's a process happening there. That's not by accident. I wouldn't be surprised if that was a familiar story for other people that have been scammed.
Like, I even offered him a lift home because he was waiting on the bus, apparently, to Letterkenny. And I found out he's not even from Letterkenny. He's living in Omagh. And he was standing at the bus stop waiting. And I said, well, do you want us to take you home? And no, it's grand. I'm waiting on the bus. And I was, I just take people as I find them. And I'm just too kind, in a sense. And I just was, on this occasion, it was me that was caught. So hopefully nobody else will fall victim to him.
But it seems, because you took the picture, you got the name out there, you've got good information, and you're having a meeting with the police. So I suppose at this case, the two things that can happen, A, is get that warning out there, because you know now that you're not the only person that was scammed like this, but also B, to retrieve the watch. You know, you hope that, I presume,
that would be ideally would be great,
All right, okay.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thanks for helping us get the message out there, Sinead. It's,
no,
it's a sickener,
thank you very
no
much
doubt
for
about
the call,
it.
Greg.
But it's not a simple scam, it's a complex one. There's a lot of layers to that between the app, and unfortunately, now with certain AI models, those apps are very easy. Those apps are very easy to replicate, but also to have a balance in there, just in case you were to ask about that.
Yeah.
And also to have
people
information.
Just need to be aware.
Yeah. And have information that sort of goes, right, this can't be reversed, as if in some way it's locked into your account. Okay. Thanks very much, Sinead.
Yeah.
Look after yourself. Thank you. If anyone else has fallen victim to that, let us know. 086 60 25000. Any word of the hub starting Letterkenny Hospital full capacity the past few days? Well, it's action stations down at the hospital, I would imagine, in trying to get things sorted. That is a process, and that process is ongoing. It's not going to be something that's going to alleviate the situation anytime soon. And just in case you don't know the context of that, the HSC themselves issued another service update. Letterkenny University Hospital, extremely busy. They've had an awful lot of patients through the door in the last number of days. Patients are seen based on clinical urgency. If your condition is non-urgent, you will face very long waiting times. If you have an emergency, obviously, such as chest pain or breathing difficulties, do go to the ED. It's very important that, by the way, that when we talk about how busy the ED is, they are given the impression it's busy with people that don't necessarily need to be there, not emergency cases, some of them. But if you are in an emergency, please call the emergency services or get to the ED. You're being encouraged to do that. If you've got non-urgent conditions, you're asked to consider all other care options, i.e. GP, pharmacy or the out-of-hours GP services. But I know for many of you that's an issue as well. So the hospital really, really busy, and they're trying very hard to discharge patients who are well enough to be discharged. But I talked about how, you know, there are people clearly in the ED that perhaps don't necessarily need to be there. But there are lots of people that do need to be there that are waiting extraordinary long periods of time to get into a hospital bed. The hospital is full, but there are people in those beds that don't necessarily need to be in there yet. And then you've got dozens of others waiting to get into those beds. But I understand that every effort is being made to speed up discharges today to get some of those people into beds. Now, there has been widespread upset after St. Union's College in Letterkenny was overlooked for funding under the first tranche of the National Development Plan rollout for 2026 and 2027. The college has over 1,000 students and a growing waiting list. Currently, it can't take any more students. And unfortunately, again, was unsuccessful in the countrywide announcement, which left only one successful school in Donegal, St. Columbus in Stranola, which is fantastic news for St. Columbus. But this came as a big, big shock to St. Union's. Rory Bradley is a sixth-year student on the Students' Council. And good morning to you, Rory.
Good morning.
And Shay Deasley is also a sixth-year student. Good morning to you, Shay.
Good morning, Greg.
Thanks, both of you, for joining us. Now, I know some of the students were out, was it on Friday, with a petition? It's good to see students getting involved in this. I know you weren't, but that was transition year students.
Yeah, on Thursday there, we had a number of students there in the town just expressing how we feel about this. And it did come as a big shock to us as the students as well. But we were delighted with the engagement we got from the local community, and we got loads and loads of signatures and a lot of positive feedback.
Shay, was there an expectation that this that the school would be included in this latest round of funding?
I suppose from past experience, it maybe wasn't an expectation, but we did kind of expect, but we were deeply hopeful it would be included, Greg, because we've been on this road for a long time. We were included in the Adapt 2 programme in 2019, which is a fast-track programme for schools which
I remember at the time, I think Joe McHugh was the Minister for Education at the time, and he was saying, this is amazing, this is brilliant news. It was welcomed by Charlie McConnellogue as well. Like, that seemed like, right, fast track means it's going to be done. That's what you think, isn't it, Shay? And that was now 7 years ago.
Yeah, that was 7 years ago. We joined the Adapt 2 fast track programme, and that is for schools which are in need of new buildings and new accommodation. So we thought we were well on the way then, and once we got the plan permission through in 2022, we thought, right, we're getting there, like we're nearly there, and we thought the fund would soon come afterwards. But unfortunately now we're here, Greg, in 2026, and we feel like we're not back at square one, because we're going to fight this and try and get the fund. But it's very disappointing, you know, like, because with plan permission ends in March 2027, so we feel like we have to act now.
Yeah, and Rory, you know, obviously this isn't about you guys. You have taken your time out of your mocks to highlight this issue for those that come behind you.
Yeah, we came into school in 2020. The feeling we thought was that there would be some ground broken before we'd come out of the school, and now we're in sixth year doing our mocks, and it's not about us anymore. It's about the next generation coming forward. It's about everyone coming forward and the people who came before us, who worked so hard to get this programme to where it is today.
And to get to this point whereby you are in the running for funding, it takes so much work and so much money.
A lot of work was done even over the COVID years. And it was a lot of, even our student council has sent letters to the Minister for Education. There in 2024, we hosted previous Minister Norma Foley to the school. But she refused to take the student council tour of the school building and the facilities. And we didn't really get a chance to express as a student council our feelings on the project. And we're just worried as to what's the next steps forward. We're just looking for clarity and communication from the department as to where we go with this and what the plan is.
Yeah, well, let's have a quick listen to Deputy Charles Ward, who brought up this issue in the Dáil in recent days.
Taoiseach, I want to address the decision announced last week to exclude St Union's College Letterkenny from the latest school capital funding allocation. I need to be clear about this. This is an issue of a school that is doing what they could do, getting everything ready, engaging with the department. Planning permission has been in place since 2022, and an agreed pathway for progression has been made. I recently visited the college there last week, and it's overcrowded, and temporary buildings are now becoming permanent. The children in the community have the right to dignity and safety at home and at school. They've been failed twice now, and going from unsafe homes to unsafe learning environments is not ideal. Only one Donegal project was approved for funding, which is welcome, but other counties received multiples. I'm asking you to look at this decision, revisit a matter of urgency, so that we can work with St Unions, and will the government commit to immediately engage with St Unions College to fix this injustice, because they need all the help
Thank
they can
you.
Get.
Taoiseach.
First of all, again, I will talk to the Minister for Education in respect to the college that you've raised, but there's a broader issue. We've dramatically increased spending for second level schools and primary schools in terms of the investment. And the National Development Plan represents a further expansion and increase in projects. But we will continue to keep all of this under review, and we will do everything we can to progress as many schools as we possibly can that need extensions or indeed complete new builds in some cases.
So no firm commitment from the Taoiseach, but interesting to hear the school being mentioned on the floor of the Dáil. And what politicians don't often get, I think, is that to address a concern about a school not progressing by saying we're investing more money, it actually makes the situation feel worse than it is, because if you are investing more money and that's what your response is, then what is the reason for the likes of St Union's to be overlooked? Shay, the problem is we're not the only county complaining. I think Sligo, Leitrim, Mayo, no schools. We got one school. But the pressure has to be kept on, I presume. That's how you would frame it.
Yeah, I suppose the biggest question, Greg, as you said, with more money being invested is for the students and the teachers and everybody involved in the St Union's community is why. The question we have for all our public representatives is why. Why we've been included yet again, because, as I said, it's been such a long road, and we just feel like now has to be the time for St Union's College to progress towards the tender stage and to start getting some ground broke, because just feels like it kind of has to happen sooner rather than later, Greg.
Yeah, and I know, Rory, that everyone tries their best to do their best with the facilities. But is it obvious as a student that the site is cramped?
I mean, we have the facilities are in the shape that they are, and our teachers work to the best of their ability to give us that. But the likes of the woodwork rooms, there's two woodwork rooms for over 1,000 boys. There's 8 toilet cubicles for over 1,000 boys. It is obvious in our daily life. We make the best of it, and we do get what we can out of it, but you know, it needs change.
Yeah, and if you have a school, just using your example, if you've got a school with excellent woodworking facilities, students at St Union's instantly become as a disadvantage, even with the best will in the world. Shay, what I know both of you have made some really good points, some strong points today, but what do you really want to get across just in the last few moments, Shay?
I suppose, first of all, we are proud to be standing fully behind the Parent Association and the work and petition on the petition on change.org. Over the past week, some people would have seen students have been down around the town collecting signatures on paper and online, and they've put out over 100 posters with QR codes around businesses throughout the town to make it easy for people to support our petition. Later today, students from the Student Council, including Chairperson Kobe Farrell and Mark Reynolds, are going to go to the Dáil in Dublin to meet with a cross-party delegation of TDs and senators. They'll be meeting to discuss, I suppose, the lack of progress yet again, and to try and work out a way forward and to seek clarity and answers. I think that's the biggest thing that we want, Greg. It is clarity and answers. And I suppose that we would encourage members of the community to support the campaign by signing the petition, which they can find on our Facebook page, and also to email the Department of Education at info@education.gov.ie, supposed to voice their concern, and also to email at hildegard.nocton@oireachtas.ie to again voice their concerns and to support our concerns in the college.
Yeah, and Rory, do you just reiterate that, or is there anything you want to add?
I reiterate that it's mainly we can get behind this as a community. We can show where we're at. We have about 3,600 signatures on our online petition at the minute, and we're trying to drive that forward. The goal is about 10,000.
Yeah, and I think really what people need to sort of do is realise that this is something they can get behind. You're not looking for money or anything. You're just looking for a signature. And, you know, from a county of our size, if you got to 10,000, that's hard to ignore.
Yeah.
Because I think really the schools that are going to benefit are the schools that make the most noise. That's just the way it is, and that's what you're here for today, to try and ramp up the noise. Okay, interesting. Well, we'll track that meeting down in the Dáil, that cross-party meeting. We'll chase that up, of course, either on the show or in the newsroom. But for now, lads, thanks very much indeed. Obviously, they did something right because you are two fine young lads, so well done to you. You should be very proud of yourselves. That's Rory Bradley, sixth-year student on the Students' Council, a fellow councillor. Shay Deasley, also a sixth-year student. Deputy Owen O'Brien, Sinn Féin Housing Spokesperson. Martin Wai, thank you so much for joining us today.
Greg, thanks for having me on.
Right, now, I was just, as we had a wee glance through the newspapers today, covering a story in The Independent, which I believe comes off the back of an investigation from your party. New rent rules would hike tenants' bills by over 5,000 annually in parts of the country. In Donegal, that would be just shy of 2,000 euro. What has happened with this policy that is actually going to see the cost of renting increase so significantly when it's, I thought, about making rental property more accessible?
That's exactly the question, Greg. So the government last week and this week are rushing through a very controversial piece of legislation, the centrepiece of which is a very profound change to the way in which landlords will be able to set rents for new tenancies. It's important to stress that if you're a current tenant and you remain in your current property, you're not going to be affected by these new rules. But essentially what the legislation will allow a landlord to do is, when one tenant moves out and the other tenant moves in, to reset the rent to market rent. Based on data published by the Residential Tenancies Board, we published a detailed assessment of what that additional cost would be. The average additional rent for a new renter from the 1st of March this year, if the rent is reset to market rent, will be about 3,000 euros a year. Donegal is a little bit less than that because your overall rents are a bit lower, but it's still a very hefty 2,000 euros a year. And in Galway City, where the gap between existing and new rents is the highest, it would be 5,000 euros a year. And the problem is, not only are these huge sums of money, but the actual number of new rental tenancies created each year is about 60,000. It's about a quarter of all registered tenancies. So, for example, in County Donegal, where the rents are already pushing between 1,500 and 2,000 euros a month, if you look on daft.ie this morning, not only are new renters going to face very significant bills, but the large number of students from County Donegal in the northwest who travel to Galway or to Dublin or to Maynooth or Cork, who typically would have tenancies from September to April, May or June, when they go back to college in September in the mainstream private rental sector, they and their parents are going to see really big increases in their annual rent. And when we're in the middle of a cost of living crisis,
yeah, it's already, just to,
where rents are so high, that's completely unacceptable.
Just to talk to that, I mean, like, I would know two cases, and maybe this isn't even a lot, but it feels a lot to me. One young person working down in Galway, $650 a month for a box room. Like, you couldn't swing a cat in it. And seven or eight people living in that house. Another room available for rent, sharing, you know, £550 a month, sharing a room with another person. I mean, that's unsustainable. The thing I don't understand, though, Owen, is if I had a property to rent, why would I leave, you know, potentially $2,000 or $3,000 sitting on the table? It's my private property, right? I'm going to try and find a way to get someone out of that house, aren't I? And I know they say 6 years tenancy and all that kind of stuff, but it's an awful lot to say that just by luck, if you have a property to rent for new, right, you're going to get this nice amount of cash. And if you just happen to have a tenant in, why be loyal to them? Because you're going to leave so much money that could be going towards your mortgage or your lifestyle on the table. I don't understand it.
No, absolutely. And that's one of the big fears, particularly for that percentage of landlords who might opt to play fast and loose with the rules. But also, given that these changes were actually announced half a year ago, we've seen a significant number of rental properties where a sitting tenant voluntarily moved out. Maybe they bought a home, or maybe they moved abroad, or they got a job elsewhere. Those properties have remained vacant as landlords have been waiting to avail of this change. And it's really important to remember, like, the rent pressure zones were a very badly designed form of rent regulation. We argued very strongly that they would have lots of problems at the start. But they have provided both sitting tenants and tenants where there's a change of tenancy with a modest level of protection. Despite that, of course, rents are still far too high. And yet here we have a government in the middle of a cost of living crisis, essentially in one quick manoeuvre, removing that modest protection for up to 60,000 new renters a year. Now, the big question is, Greg, why are they doing this? And if you listen to the minister and the government TDs who are supporting this, they say they want to incentivise large-scale pension fund institutional investment into the private rental sector to deliver more supply. And over time, while yes, rents will go up, they will eventually come down. The first thing I would say is first of all, people in Donegal or the Northwest, you're not going to get any of that pension fund investment. It's only going to come to small parts of Dublin and Cork, where there's high density, high rent developments. But also, it will do nothing to reduce rents in the short, medium or long term. It will just lock in unaffordable rents in perpetuity. But this government has become completely captured by the big institutional investors. And when, you know, Irish Institutional Property, the main lobby group for these big players, says to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, jump, the answer of Micheál Martin and Simon Harris is how high.
Yeah, but I'm not saying
renters with €3,000 and €5,000 extra a year.
I'm not saying I agree with you. That's the position of Sinn Féin. But, you know, if you look at the last budget, it does feel like these funds or these developers have the government by the ghoulies, because, you know, they had to make it more attractive for them to start moving forward on planning permissions, for an example, to try and bring some of this property onto the market. And as you say, it's all in Dublin. It's not in Donegal. But that, to me, at that time, talked to the influence that this sector actually has on policy making, which, you know, that means that tap can be turned off and on at will.
Absolutely. And what's really important is even the economists who are sympathetic to that approach of government have said publicly this will only lead to a limited amount of increased supply in very specific areas. Of course, we know that there isn't an adequate supply of the right kind of homes at the right price in the right place. But the idea that allowing large institutional landlords to build smaller, darker apartments, which government is allowing, and to charge ever higher rents as a solution to our housing crisis in Dublin or Donegal is ludicrous.
So what is the solution?
We need government to focus on the private supply that is most needed, and that is supporting small and medium-sized builder developers in every county in the state to increase the quantum of really good quality homes at more moderate prices for working people to buy, alongside more social affordable homes. That's the solution. Not giving big pension fund
but
investors
if the government were
tax
to do
breaks,
that, if the
lower design standards and higher rents,
yeah, but if
that
the,
is not going to solve the problem for anyone.
Yes, but Owen, if the government were to do that, right, it might start to service need where it is, but it might not deliver the 40, 35, 40, 50,000 houses, because the quick way to do that, right, is to get 40 apartments built at one time in Dublin. you're calling on the government to sort of maybe, and you can correct me where I'm wrong on that, of course, but you're calling on the government to sort of try and seed around the country. But if they weren't delivering the numbers then on an annual basis that they probably couldn't, yous would be the first up in the door saying, you know, we need such and such amount of houses and you're not doing it.
Let's be very clear. The institutional investors and the developers who build for them, who will be attracted by this package, are only going to deliver very specific types of stock in specific places. The real issue is, if you look at private housing, we've about 20 small, medium-sized builder developers around the country. Many of them are very well-known household names. If government policy focused on those sectors, getting them access to lower cost finance, more timely planning permissions, more cost-effective site servicing, etc., they could double their output. That is how you get the private sector output up and running. But also on the public sector side, the delivery of social, affordable rental and affordable purchase homes is far too slow and the numbers are far too few. So if we want to give working people in Donegal, in Sligo, in Mayo, in Dublin, in Cork or elsewhere access to social, affordable and private for purchase homes, then actually the solution is the public sector and the small and medium-sized builder-developer sector. It's not a small number of big institutional investors, because all they are going to deliver under the government plans is a small number of darker, more expensive apartments in high-cost parts of Dublin. And that's not the solution to the crisis that we need. But the bottom line is this, whatever about our debate over what's the best way to increase the right kind of supply, the legislation that's going to be rammed through the Dáil tomorrow in 5 hours is going to have a hugely detrimental impact on tens of thousands of renters, students and working people in every county across the state from March onwards. And what does this say? This say that this government simply doesn't care about renters. It doesn't care about the cost of living crisis. It just wants to give tax breaks and increase profits to a small number of institutional investors, whose lobby organisation, by the way, is led by a former General Secretary of Fianna Fáil, Pat Farrell. What a surprise.
What do you think of the changes to short-term lets? It doesn't seem to apply to Donegal at all now, except for Letterkenny. The population is 22,000, that's more than the 20. I don't know if that's the official figure that gets caught in this, but effectively, there'll be no restrictions, except potentially in Letterkenny, on short-term lettings in Donegal, as far as I can see. Am I reading that correctly? And do you believe that to be the right move?
So that appears to be the case in terms of the briefings government is giving in advance of Cabinet. They were originally talking about a kind of a threshold of urban areas of 10,000 or more, that there would be a very strict regime, and then some kind of other regime outside of that, the detail of which still hasn't been published. We've argued for a long time that there has to be a twin-track approach to the regulation of short-term letting in urban areas, particularly urban areas that have very high rents, a lack of rental supply and high homelessness. Properties that were given planning permission for long-term residential occupation should not allow to be short-term let. But in those rural areas and in those high-amenity tourist areas, there needs to be a slightly more flexible approach. And we've long advocated that there should be a low-cost bespoke regularisation procedure for people engaged in short-term letting, but the local authority ultimately should be allowed to decide what is the right quantum of short-term letting in those areas. And that would be particularly relevant to rural parts of Donegal. This idea of a 10,000 or 20,000 euro cap is completely arbitrary, is not based on any objective assessment of the housing crisis in our urban areas. And it will leave many places behind that are in desperate need of homes that were given planning permission for long-term residential occupation to be returned to long-term residential occupation. So we support the register that the government has been introducing, as do most people. We think there should be a degree of flexibility in those rural and more tourism areas. But the government is getting this badly wrong yet again. And who are going to be the big losers?
I think so. We still need to strike the balance between, you know, people visiting certain areas and the ability for local people in those areas to have somewhere to live. It might not be on the scale of a Dublin or a Galway or even a Letterkenny, but there are places all around Donegal where locals have nowhere to live, and houses are lying, hundreds of houses are lying empty for, you know, 9 or 10 months of the year. And that individual's need in Downing's, for an example, is equal to that individual's need in Dublin. But because of the way it's structured with figures, those people in the smaller areas are left homeless or moving out of their area or living in a, you know, a bedroom of their parents' house.
I completely agree. And when I talk to my colleagues who represent the rural constituencies, Port McLaughlin, Pearse Doherty and Donegal, or Roscommon, Walsh and Mayo, or Pad Daly down in Kerry, they say exactly the same thing. And keep in mind, if we want a vibrant tourism sector in these predominantly rural and small town areas, then the people who run tourism businesses, they need places for their staff to live. So the difficulty here is there's no logic to the cap that the government has proposed. There's no clarity in terms of the way in which the planning regime is going to operate in those more rural countryside areas. And again, I want to stress, our view is there should be a very tough set of rules in those urban areas where there's a deep housing crisis, and a more flexible regime with the ability of the local authority to make good decisions in the best interest of those rural and smaller townland areas. What we seem to be getting at the minute is the worst of both possible worlds. And again, when I'm talking to people who are involved in very legitimate short-term letting businesses in important parts of rural Ireland, or people who run historic buildings that would never be let out in the private rental sector, their problem is they don't even know what the government's plan is because the register is coming into place very soon. But the planning regulations, none of us have seen, none of us have had an opportunity to scrutinise or debate. So my big worry is the government is making a mess of this again. And who are going to be the losers? Just like with the market rent reset and the thousands of euros of extra rent in a year, people who desperately need to access rental accommodation in urban and parts of rural Ireland will be left behind once again. And you're absolutely right. One of the consequences of that is increased homelessness. The other consequence is people being forced to move back at home with their parents or have to consider to emigrate. This is not a way to run a housing system.
And those, the problem I have is the people that are feel they have to leave, or those that are in still living with the parents. We don't know that number. It's like those struggling on pay-as-you-go meters and electricity. We don't know. We don't have that data. And I would wonder how you can really form effective policy without that information. But anyway, go ahead.
What we do know, Greg, is the number of people in their 20s and 30s living at home with their parents.
Yes, but we don't know why, though. Yeah, of course, you can presume from that.
But you and I are around long enough to know a large volume of that is the lack of affordable accommodation for young people, particularly as they want to make the transition out of the family home and into setting up their own home and their own family and employment. And the lack of affordable housing, and that's on government and it's their failure, is the primary driver of that.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Sinn Féin deputy and Sinn Féin housing spokesperson Eoghan Óbrin.
If it matters to you, it matters to us. The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Welcome back. On the issue of St Eunan's, a listener says, quick analysis of school building fund as seven very populated and expanded counties getting most of the funding, i.e. Dublin, Cork, Limerick, Galway, Meath, Kildare and Louth, with some new start-up schools required. Rural counties fared poorly, with Donegal, Leitrim, Longford, Roscommon and Wicklow getting just one project. Sligo, Mayo, Cavan and Offaly getting no funding at all. And we are at a point whereby, obviously, we don't need a two-tier country. So now is the time, surely, whereby you invest more in different parts of the country, don't you? So that success, and success can follow education, is spread more widely. On the issue of housing, morning, Greg. How can we trust Sinn Féin when they said that they would impose laws that could take people's second homes, holiday homes, B&Bs and land because there is a housing crisis? The government has loads of money, but they're choosing to house migrants, Ukrainians, bike sheds and a hospital, which is costing billions, etc., etc. Thank you. My analysis of the housing situation, regardless of whether it's Sinn Féin in power, and listen, you know, with the best will in the world, to think that maybe they could, but to think another party could come in and all of a sudden jump all of the hurdles that's required, take on the investors, take on the developers and take on the civil servants and all of a sudden deliver 100,000 houses a year. Come on, like, you know, I mean, you'd like to think it's possible, but is it? The problem is I don't believe if you put 50 billion euro into it, unless you actually were really, really rewarding already rich people, that you would see a big increase in throughput of housing. A lot of it's held up just with paperwork, it seems. Hi, I was wondering, is the main street totally closed for roadworks this week, or is it just partially closed? A colleague from work is attending a show in Ungrian on tonight and was wondering about parking. Thank you. It's down at the lower part of the main street, and it's to sort of facilitate the redevelopment of the market square. That's a long way away from Ungrian on, so I can't imagine that that's going to be an issue. The reason Letterkenny University Hospital is so packed all the time is because GPs and now docs send them to the ED because they are scared to be sued. It's also ridiculous that the doctor can't give stitches in the office. I get you, but there is also an awful lot of people in there for that reason that aren't being seen for hours on end. There are lots of people that are being admitted to the hospital and there are no beds for them. Okay, so that those people aren't caught in your scenario. They wouldn't be admitted to the hospital unless they were sick enough for them to be put in there. On St Eunan's, the St Eunan's College have been campaigning for the past 30 years for a new school. This is nothing new. Every TD and minister has promised it to be updated, but nothing has changed. The late Councillor Desi Larkin was always campaigning for this issue, and it's been an ever-present topic on this show and previous incarnations of it as well. Right, so I think we can say good morning now to the CEO of CyberSafe Kids, Alex Cooney. Alex, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, this is a very worthwhile survey, do not get me wrong, and I'm not in any way poo-pooing on it, but we're kind of getting survey after survey with very familiar tone in terms of kids' unsafe access to social media and apps, and not really making any progress, it would seem, or it feels like, in addressing those issues. We might get through that through the course of the conversation. But age limits, that's not stopping young people on the internet. That's one of the key findings jumped out at me.
That's absolutely right. And I think you're also right to observe that children don't seem to be getting any safer online. I wrote an op-ed for the Irish Examiner where I said, you know, we've had 23 safer internet days, which is the day we're highlighting today. And we have to ask our children any safer online. And I don't think they are. I would actually argue they're even less safe online than they were 23 years ago, which is a really sad thing to say. Age limits aren't working. No. The only thing that's working in that regard is, I would say, these hold off movements that we're seeing emerge around the country, different communities, often school, you know, linked to different schools, parents coming together to say, you know, we don't want this for our kids. We think it's better to hold off a little bit longer before giving them the smartphone or giving them access to social media. And I think that's a really good thing.
Yes, and I think really that's where we're going to crack the nut here, because there's probably some either parents turning a blind eye or some parents' complicity in bypassing the age limits on social media, you know, the 13 pluses or whatever it is, depending on the social media. We are also allowing our children onto roadblocks despite all of the warnings. And also what we aren't doing, which I think is critical, is educating ourselves as to the guardrails that are there in terms of chats, who can contact your child, the privacy of accounts, you know, general oversight. We're not doing that as parents.
We're definitely not doing enough. And we've released some findings from two surveys today. So one is a survey of children, 3,300 primary school children. And the other is 1,700 parents, which is information we've been gathering over the last year or so. And in both, we see that highlighted, the fact that parental controls aren't being used. There isn't enough parental oversight. The ground rules they're putting in place aren't being enforced. You know, and that's the parents that I would argue are probably a bit more engaged anyway, so we definitely have more to do to support parents, to upskill parents. We know that they feel on the back foot on this one, so we definitely need to do more to support them. It isn't an area often that they were parented on themselves, so we don't have that kind of, I suppose, roadmap that we were given as children. You know, and for example, teaching them to ride a bike or something. So this is why we're launching the Same Rules Apply campaign, to kind of get that message across. I don't, however, want to put it all on parents, because I think there is a lot more that needs to be done, both to support parents, but also to ensure children will be safer online. And that comes back to tech company responsibility.
Yeah, it is. And also, too, we have to remember that this is native technology for the young people. They have the private TikTok, the private Snapchat, and the public TikTok and the public Snapchat. And it's a lot for expect parents to navigate all of that as well in what is a sort of a really busy time to live as is. So what are the other key findings? Over half of children don't have any parental restrictions about interacting with strangers on the internet. 25% of boys aged 8 to 12 had some of their social media accounts set to public, compared to 16% of girls, 34%. Yeah, but you see, when it's set to public, that doesn't that doesn't really tell the full story either, does it? Because we don't know what's going on in those private settings that could have 200 or 300 people in them.
Well, you're right. And also, if you have friends and followers that you don't actually know offline, then you are still sharing in a public way. And what we see with children when we ask them this, you know, why do you accept friend requests from people that you don't know for those kids that do? And often, most often, it's because it's a friend of a friend. It seems safer. It seems more known. But, you know, then you would say, well, does your friend actually know that person? It gets a little more vague. You know, I've asked my own kids this question and, oh, yeah, it's definitely somebody they know. But I think we need to put a lot more scrutiny on that. We need to support and teach children why it's important to not share information so publicly or with people that we don't know. So there's stuff we could be doing at home in terms of conversations that we're having with our kids, you know, as parents, but we could also be doing a lot more in schools as well to upskill kids, ensure that they're going to be critical thinkers, that they're, you know, critically engaging with the content and the people they're encountering online.
The one thing that has seemed to happen over the years, and maybe it's just me misinterpreting it, is the age of the children we're talking about. Like, I seem to recall us talking about 11, 12, 13, 14 year olds, and now we're talking about 7 out of 10 children between 8 and 12 having a social media account on apps with a legal age of 13. It does really feel that we have moved to the point where the majority of proper kids, if that makes sense, you know what I mean? An 8 or 9 year old shouldn't be on social media, surely, but the majority of them are.
Yeah, you're right. So I think that tells us that the minimum age restrictions are not working. This whole self-declaration of age is inadequate as a means of determining someone's actual age. I think it brings questions around the regulation. We have, in theory, an online safety code, which is in full force from July 2025. In theory, all the video sharing platforms based in Ireland were supposed to bring in robust age assurance measures to ensure that there were no underage users accessing their services. I don't know. I mean, they were literally supposed to have done it by the time that, you know, code came into full effect. I think it was the 20th July, 2025. And I still don't know whether that's the case. You know, so I think we need to do a lot more to ensure that the regulation that exists enforced is enforced. But I also don't think the regulation goes far enough. So, for example, we allow these very large online platforms, as they're described under this European legislation, to self-assess their own risk. I mean, that's like getting a child to mark their own homework. You know, why are we allowing these companies who have built no public trust in their ability to manage risk effectively to assess their own levels of risk? That should be an independent assessment. And as should the age rating, quite frankly, a bit like a film classification board. You know, the film producers don't get to choose the age rating of their film. That is an independent assessment, and it is an independent age given. Mm. So we need to move to a different model to really tackle this.
Yeah, and I just think we could take a step out in it. You know, one of the, ironically, the greatest self-proclaimed defender of children is Elon Musk. This is what he'd have us believe. He described moves in Italy to ban under 16s from social media. He described the premier over there as a tyrant. You know, that's what you're up against. It's not about protecting children. It constantly gets tied into this conversation about freedom of speech, freedom of expression, because, of course, to prove people are under a certain age, everybody has to prove that they're over that age. And I just think, you know, we host a lot of these companies. We seem to have watered down a commitment to take a look at under 16s or under 15s or whatever it might be. There's something going on here where there's more external power being exercised, because if this was truly about protecting children, there wouldn't be any debate, Alex, about, say, under 13s being banned off social media if we can't get over under 16s over the line.
I mean, we should be questioning why somebody like Elon Musk wields so much power that he gets to throw around. You know, he called the British Prime Minister a fascist a couple of weeks ago when Keir Starmer announced measures to investigate what Grok was doing. So I don't know why we allow these people. And of course, under President Trump, there's been a lot of protection for big tech companies in a time when we actually need to be regulating them more. They have so much power. They have lobbied extensively over the last 20 years to block legislative proposals to allow essentially for self-regulation to continue. You know, we hear this phrase, self-regulation is over. It isn't. There's so much that is left to the discretion of these companies. Still, the model is wrong. It goes right back to the business model, which is all about engagement, all about commercial gain. And unless we tackle that and ensure that children are going to be protected from that, we're really not going to get to the heart of it. And even banning kids doesn't address that reform that's required to the actual business model.
Okay, Alex, thanks so much indeed. Alex Cooney there, who is CEO of CyberSafe Kids. And there's something going on globally in terms of the protection of children that doesn't align with what I'm feeling, what I know you, the listeners, are feeling. Thankfully, with the fallout from the Epstein files, which, in case it's not perfectly clear, is about the trafficking and abuse of children in the most horrific, horrific way. Thankfully, in Britain, there seems to be some level of accountability. We're seeing it in other countries around the world, Poland, in Norway, isn't it, as well? But in America, people are so politically polarised that the safety and welfare of children is a political football to kick around the place. It's absolutely astonishing. And unfortunately, those same people that are kicking that football around the place are the same people that are heavily invested in social media. Mark Zuckerberg, who owns WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook, and Elon Musk, who owns X and then one of the biggest AI platforms in the world, both of them had a sit-down dinner with a convicted paedophile in Jeffrey Epstein. And this is not fake. They both sat down and had a dinner with him, with this person who is a little rat of a person, really. Nothing to him at all. But he wielded so much power and got those billionaires sitting down for dinner with him. And these are the same people that are resisting protecting our children, associating with a known paedophile. I mean, and yet no one, certainly in America, seems to care about that. It seems to be more about, you know, whether Bad Bunny was better than someone or other, or Bad Bunny sang in Spanish at the Super Bowl. What about the children?
The Community Garda information slot is brought to you by Sheridan Security Systems, monitoring homes and businesses in the Northwest for intruder, fire, panic and medical signals. Call Sheridan Security on 91-26025.
It's Tuesday the 10th of February, 25 minutes past 10, time for this week's edition of Community Garda information, and I'm joined in studio by Garda Grainne Doherty from the Letterkenny Garda Station. Grainne, thanks so much for calling
in. No problem. Good morning, Greg.
Right, quite a bit to get through, as always. So let's start with appeals and criminal damage being investigated at the Diamond.
Yes, this incident happened on Saturday the 7th of February between approximately 7:15pm and 10:30pm in the area of the Diamond in Donegal Town. So a parked car was damaged between those times. The bonnet was keyed and substantial damage was caused to it. Repeating to anybody who might have witnessed this incident to make contact with Gardaí in Ballyshannon on 071 985 8530 or any relevant information may be passed on alternatively via the Garda confidential line on 1800 666 111.
7:15 and 10:30pm in the evening. Yeah. Lots and lots of people about. Someone's going to have information. No one would want to be on the receiving end of that. Get in touch with Ballyshannon Gardaí if you have the info. Staying in the south of the county, a two-vehicle collision. Is this Clare in Donegal Town?
This is Clare Redcastle.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so Tuesday the 3rd of February, in and around 9:30pm, a two-vehicle collision occurred at Clare Redcastle, so on the R238. One of these vehicles, it was a grey Volkswagen Golf. It had been travelling from Moville towards Redcastle, and they were struck by an oncoming vehicle, a black Mercedes Sprinter van. The driver of the van left the vehicle on foot. No injuries were reported, but damage was caused to both vehicles. So we're appealing to anybody who might have witnessed this collision to contact Gardaí in Buncrana on 932-0540. We're also appealing to anybody who might have travelled along that route with a dash cam between 9pm and 10pm on that date to please make that footage available to us.
Road traffic collision in Buncrana being investigated.
Yes, this collision occurred on the Swilly Road, Buncrana, on Wednesday the 4th of February, shortly before 9:30pm. So a vehicle, a blue Hyundai, it was being driven from the shorefront direction towards Buncrana Pier on the Swilly Road, and it was approached by a red BMW. It was reportedly travelling towards it at speed and it collided with it. The red BMW left the scene then. It was driven onwards towards the railway road. No injuries were reported. We're appealing to anybody who might have travelled in those areas between 9pm and 10pm with a dash cam to please make that footage available to us.
Yes, go ahead.
No, just any relevant information can be passed to Gardaí in Buncrana on 932-0540.
Okay, a reported fraud incident in Pettigo next.
Yes, this is a very concerning incident, actually. Tuesday the 27th of January, so between approximately 4:30 p.m. and 4:45 p.m, the time has been narrowed down to that time frame, quite a short time frame. An elderly resident, they're living in the area of Terman Villas in Pettigo. They had a visit from a man who wasn't known to him. The caller in question was described as being in his 40s, of average height, heavy set, clean shaven, round faced and wore dark clothing, and he was also wearing a dark beanie style hat. He asked the resident if he had lost any money, and then he invited himself into the house. So when inside, he then inquired of this elderly resident about what money was within the property. And when the money was produced, he said he wanted to help him count it to check that it was all there. He then stated that he had to check the money further by scanning it, and he left with the money and he didn't return. So the man in question, this caller to this property, was travelling in a small white van, and it's believed that he travelled to the house from the direction of the Lough Derg Road, and he also left in the same direction. We're appealing to anybody who might have travelled along that route or within the general Pettigo area between 4 p.m. and 5 p.m. on Tuesday the 27th of January with a dash cam to please make that footage available to us. And if anybody residing along that road, the Lough Derg Road, has CCTV or doorbell cameras, it might assist greatly with our investigation. If Gardaí have not yet called with them, we're asking them to please make us aware that they have that footage. Any relevant information should be passed to Gardaí in Ballyshannon on 071 985 8530, or again the Garda Confidential line 1800 666 111.
And it'd be useful maybe at this point to get a reminder of some advice, but just to recap the description of this person. He's been described as in his 40s, of average height, heavy set, clean shaven, round faced and wore dark clothing. At the time he was wearing a dark beanie type hat. So that's a very strong description there. And of course, you know, we have lots of people listening down in that part of the world as well. But when this is posted onto the social media, if you've got anyone who are friends in that area, please tag them into it as well. To try and get that information out there, just in case anyone missed it. So there is advice. Now, you nor I would never victim blame. Unfortunately, there's a shock and awe element to this to get in the door. These people are very good at what they're doing,
of
right?
Of course, they're very convincing. Yeah.
So really, we have to try and do as much as we can to give ourselves that space to sort of reflect on the situation. And the door chain, it's the most simplest of devices, isn't it, really? But it allows you to open the door and not feel like you're ignoring people or being ignorant, but also maybe to screen the situation.
Yeah, and exactly. And as you said, these people are so convincing. And if you're there on your own in a property and somebody comes to your door, and, you know, they're coming across as totally plausible and they're charming and they're being well-mannered, you know, and they do ask if they come in. It can be very hard, I suppose, for a person to say, no, you can't, because they think they're coming across as being rude.
Well, the start-off was, I'm trying to help you. You might have lost money and I'm the person exactly. can assist in that. That's the start point. That that's how devious they are.
That's exactly, and convincing, yeah. So the chain lock is invaluable, you know, and they're very inexpensive to fit. So we would advise people, please do fit a chain lock to your door and don't fully open the door to anybody that you don't know, regardless of who they say they are or why they're there. Ensure even when you're at home that your doors and windows are secured. Don't keep large amounts of cash at home. And tape your air code beside your phone in case you need to contact Gardaí and you want them to attend, you know, fairly swiftly. Just have your air code there, especially if you're living out in a rural area. You know, the time difference that would save a lot of time if we have your air code. And if you're ever in doubt about a caller, the best thing to do is keep them out and alert Gardaí immediately and give us a description of them, like this person. You know, just give a good description. And if you can see a registration number of a vehicle or a direction of travel, did they go left or right when they went out your driveway? You know, all of that's very useful to us. And we're asking people, please do keep an eye out for your elderly neighbours, family members or friends. Take a note of any callers or cars in your area that appear to be in any way suspicious and report that matter immediately to us.
Just to emphasise that, let's just hypothesise that person called to another house 10 minutes before the victim and went up to the door and says, have you lost money? And that caller says, this fella's scamming us. No, I did not. Please get off my property. At that point, that's when you ring the guards.
Exactly.
Right, because then the guards are alerted to someone who's acting suspiciously in that area and can dispatch the patrol car or whatever. Now, it may turn out that person innocently turned up at your door, but the likelihood is not. And then what that means is that by the time he or she gets to the next house, maybe the guards have intercepted. And that's really what you're saying. You know, don't presume just because you escaped the scam that that's the end
of it. Yeah, because possibly somebody else will fall victim to it.
That would be the right time there to ring the guards and say, look, there's this fella, such and such and such and such. You might want to check it out. Right, okay. Now, drug seizures.
Yes, so on the 5th of February, Gardaí from the Divisional Drugs Unit carried out a search of a premises at Duhery, County Donegal. They seized approximately 4,500 euro worth of cocaine, and that's subject to analysis, of course. A man in his 50s was arrested. He was detained under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act 1984. He was later charged, released on bail, and a court appearance will follow now on a later date. And Gardaí are appealing to anybody who has any information in relation to the sale and supply of controlled substances in Donegal or anywhere along the border region to please contact the Donegal Divisional Drugs Unit on 074 9167 100 or again the Garda Confidential Line on 1800 666 111 or any Garda station. Call into any station.
Now, following an incredibly tragic incident in Dublin in recent weeks, there was very swift moves to ban scramblers from use in public spaces and potentially to further equip the Gardaí to deal with that, and quite rightly so, and I think that's spot on. But as I was watching that story unfold, I did think of the use of quads on our roads, and, you know, I know you and your colleagues are constantly getting it out there that you know, these quads shouldn't be used on the roads. Lives have been lost. People have been crippled. And we're plugging away up here just trying to get that message out there. And I wish this was given the same sort of urgency as that situation in Dublin quite rightly was. Now, that's my view, not Garda Grainne's or on Garda Síochána's for that matter. But I'm just saying that in advance of this appeal that you have now.
Yeah, and we're regularly, I think it was only a matter of weeks ago that we spoke, actually 2 weeks running, I think we spoke about quad use by youths on roads in various areas of the county. But I have been made aware that there is an issue at present, and Gardaí are currently investigating recent reports and incidents of youths using quads on public roads in the following areas: Carrigans, St Johnson, Manor Cunningham and Newton Cunningham. So once again, we're urging parents, we want to remind parents of the dangers associated with the use of quads. We're urging them to talk to their children about the potential risks involved, both to their safety, the safety of others, and also in relation to the law that surrounds the use of these quads. They're powerful machines. They have the potential to severely or even fatally injure someone, which they have done in the past. And a quad, when a quad is used on a public road, they're subject to the same rules as any other MPV. They have to be registered, taxed. They have to be in a good roadworthy condition. The driver has to have the appropriate driving licence, and they must be insured to drive the vehicle. So we are enforcing a zero tolerance policy towards this type or any type of dangerous behaviour on our roads. We're asking parents to also enforce a zero tolerance policy before a young life or young lives are lost. Never allow your youth to use a quad on a public road. Make it known to them this behaviour won't be tolerated by you or by the Gardaí. It'll be too late to act when a tragedy happens. And unfortunately, you can see something happening down the line. This is too commonplace on our roads at present. And when guards do, I know in a recent incident in one of those areas, you know, the guards did come across some of these quads. They got the call, they went out. There was 3 to 4 quads being driven at a high speed on the road. And then, of course, the guards then don't, you know, you can't endanger lives. Yeah, you can't put any lives at risk. And so really we're begging parents today. You know,
that,
we need
that becomes part of it potentially.
It does, of course, yeah. So we have to be very aware too when we encounter them on the road that these are young people. You know, we can't put lives at risk. We've no intention of putting lives at risk, and sometimes they jet off down side roads where it's not safe to try and get them stopped. So really and truly, look, at parents are aware. They're aware if their youths have a quad, if they're using quads in public roads. We're asking them, please, nobody wants a tragedy. We don't want to be calling to anybody's door to say that their son or their daughter is lying on a roadside and that they're headed for the mortuary in Letterkenny Hospital. Mm. And really and truly, that is what the outcome will be if this behaviour isn't stopped.
All right. Sort of staying with what's happening on the roads and Garda detections and what have you. Obviously, you just highlighted a case whereby, you know, decisions have to be made about the safety to pursue, etc. But that doesn't mean Gardaí active out on the roads. And some recent instances to highlight that?
Yeah, and we regularly witness, Gardaí regularly on patrol, they witness dangerous driving incidents or receive reports of dangerous driving incidents. So a few within the past few days, I just want to highlight. So on the morning of February 6th, Ballybofey, Gardaí observed a vehicle that was being driven in a dangerous manner at Mina Crumlin, Ballybofey, so the road conditions were extremely poor at the time. It was raining quite heavily. Other drivers were being forced onto the hard shoulder as a result of the driving in question. So the driver in question was stopped. They were arrested and charged to appear in court. Then on the evening of February 7th, Karen Donaghy encountered a vehicle that had no front registration plate. So they went to turn the car to, in order to stop this car. The other driver obviously seen what was happening and seen that the guards were going to be pulling them over. They took off at a high speed and they pulled off onto a bog road. So they were forced to stop due to the rough terrain, you know, the damage that it would cause to their car. So it transpired then that this driver had a learner permit and no insurance. So this matter will now be dealt with under the Juvenile Liaison Scheme. And on, what do we see, Buncrana Roads Policing Unit, issued a fixed charge penalty notice to a driver on the night of February 8th. They had detected them travelling at 90 kilometres per hour in a 60 kilometre per hour zone. And then, it's unbelievable, less than an hour later, they detected the same vehicle being driven at 174 kilometres per hour in an 80 kilometre per hour zone. So that driver was then arrested. They were charged to appear in court and their vehicle was seized. This owner now will have to apply to the district court judge in order to get it back. And that is the case with many of the dangerous driving arrests. Their vehicle is seized under this Section 109 legislation.
I mean, that's unbelievable. You'd have to have a death wish to drive like that. But anyway, the courts will deal with people where it is appropriate. And of course, the appeal. I know it feels a little bit all over rehearsed at this stage, but we've a duty, don't we?
Yeah, well, of course, look, we're appealing weekly, you know, for people, please slow down. Speed is a massive factor in serious and fatal road traffic collisions. So slow down, behave responsibly when you're behind the wheel. You know, one irresponsible decision you make while you're behind the wheel, that could have life-changing, irreversible and very tragic consequences for you and for other road users around you. So please do have a rethink about your behaviour on the road. Help us, you know, help save lives on the road by changing. Maybe if you need to make changes to your behaviour on the road, do that. But please do slow down is the message of today.
Right, we were chatting earlier on about the Cyber Safe survey, which highlighted young people's use of social media. Today, as it turns out, it's probably not a coincidence, is Safer Internet Day.
Yes, it's February 10th. So this is Safer Internet Day. And the theme this year is AI aware, safe, smart and in control. So we're encouraging parents again, I think we have an awful picking them today, parents, I'm picking I'm asking parents today to check out webwise.ie. There's a parents hub in there, it's brilliant, it's full of information for parents, helpful tips on how you can keep your children safe online. You can find ideas, resources also, and ways to get involved with Safer Internet Day. You know, so many children, all children really are using, you know, they're all online and using different apps and platforms that maybe parents aren't just quite up to date with, you know.
Well, 70% of 8 to 12 year olds are on social media.
They are, of course, yeah. Well, you know.
I can't believe it's, but that's.
Yeah, well, even online games, you know, with Xboxes and PlayStations.
Well, Roblox is social media. I mean, yeah, it's not, obviously it's a universe of games and. And it's fine, actually, and even can be quite educational if you get the settings right.
Exactly. And there's settings there. And maybe some parents aren't aware of those settings,
yeah,
the parental
settings
that you can set. So that Webwise is brilliant. You know, if a parent isn't, you know, fully up to date with the online world and platforms and apps, it's great. Go in there, visit the parental hub in there, and you'll get great tips.
Are you any good on the internet? I'd say you're rubbish.
I'm not too bad. No,
I'd say Highland Radio, Donegal Daily, RTÉ.
Yeah.
That's about the height.
I'd be a bit of a dinosaur. I would be a bit of a dinosaur. But I have to say, now where the children are concerned, I do read up on, you know, I read up on all these games that they would be playing or accessing.
Yeah.
I do. I stay up on top of. Well, I try to stay on top of those. I know as best I can, and I set the parental controls and things like that.
Like, because if you set a tablet up. And there has to be some compromise. But if you set a tablet you can set it up as a child's tablet. And it means that anything they do, you have access to. But I think what the problem is the young ones are getting to a certain age that the actual issue is that row. All my friends do this. I want to do that. Why are you like this? And we have to have so much resilience, and I'm speaking to myself here, to keep the foot down.
It's like peer pressure for parents, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
It really is. And children are clever, they're manipulative, and they make you feel bad.
Yeah, I'd be bullied or I'd be the odd one out.
Exactly. If they storm off to your bedroom, their bedroom, we've been convinced that something could be happening to them in there. Do you know that sort of way? Because we talk so much about children's mental well-being. And it's perfectly right. I'm not saying it's wrong. But we're so hyper-aware of it, and statistics coming out about, you know, self-harm and depression and anxiety. So when you reprimand your child and they go, right, I'm going, or you send them to the room, they're in there for 10 minutes. And then you start worrying, going, I wonder what's going on in that room.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you give in. And because we're scared what might happen to them on the internet. And then we're scared what might happen to them if we stand
up to
them.
If they're not on the internet, what'll happen at school? And
that's the way we've been corralled on it. And it makes parenting really, 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 really tough.
It does. Even the issue of smartphones. I hear a lot of parents saying that, you know, they don't want to give a smartphone until a child's a certain age. But then, like that, parental peer pressure again. Or, you know, the child's coming home telling you the rest of the class have one. I'm the odd one out.
Well, that's why these contracts that they're signing in schools to not have a mobile phone until first year.
Yeah.
In secondary school, it levels the playing field.
It does, and I think that's a great thing.
I really think that is the future because unfortunately we can't rely on the social media companies, and we can rely on the state at this time.
Yep.
Right. Listen. We're talking about what kids are doing.
Yeah.
We've got thousands of grown-ups parking the cars all over the shop in Letterkenny on Sunday.
Yeah,
but I am trying to be humorous about it because sometimes everything's so bloody serious. But the truth is, what Granny's about to tell you now, you have to think about other people that use footpaths and live in the areas and stuff, and that's why it's being brought up. So Donegal versus Mayo, it's in O'Donnell Park, Letterkenny, on Sunday. 1:45 is the chuck-in. Mm-hmm. Parking, what's going on?
So parking, as always, at O'Donnell Park will be limited to those attending with relevant passes. So the area around O'Donnell Park is mainly residential, and there's no parking available out in that area. There's very limited disabled parking availability in the vicinity of the grounds. So people attending the game from the town side are encouraged to arrive early and to use the park, and there's plenty of parking spaces within the town itself, and walk to the grounds or else to avail. There's a free shuttle bus going from the foot of the Convent Road there, Cairn and Spar. Mm-hmm. It goes in and out regularly before the game. So, you know, come early and get the shuttle bus. We're appealing to everybody attending, don't park if it's illegal. You know, don't be parking up on footpaths. Don't be blocking access for wheelchair users, pushchairs. Don't park on footpaths, especially in and around Ballymacool Estate. That does be an issue at times out around that area. On footpaths along the main road or any manner that might block access for emergency services also. Gardaí will be patrolling the area on Sunday, and we're asking people to please follow directions given by Gardaí and Stewarts in the area. And of course, have an enjoyable day, and we're wishing both teams the very best of luck.
And can I just apologise to all of you parents and grown-ups and adults out there?
Yeah.
Paul Cron, you give you a wall hammering today. Yeah.
Well, I'm a parent too. I give myself a wall too.
I'm sitting there going, is she talking about me?
Oh no, we can't be finger pointing at the parents all the time. No, I know that, but you know, sometimes and fair
in a way,
to see
it's
that
actually a support. You know, it's not a criticism or it's
not
a,
at all. Trying to support them, but then the schools are such a great support, and even in relation to that, say for Internet Day, I'm going out myself now today around the schools. And
I mean, you're supposed to be there now
to do that. Yeah, to do school talks about internet safety. So children are, look at, they're getting plenty of, you know, they're getting plenty of education in relation to online safety at schools. Really and truly, the parental part of that is, it's just really to stay up to date so that you can have an open and honest conversation with your child, so that they know that you know what they're doing and that they'll feel that they're able to approach you if they're, you know, if they're worried about anything they see online or, you know.
Yeah, the lines of communication's being
the
open.
Lines, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Right, I'm joined by Richard Logue, Project Manager in Transport in London. Also keeps a clean, keen eye, of course, on political happenings. Good morning to you, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Greg. Good morning, everyone. Yeah, so I was a political activist for many years in the Labour Party, and I have a lot of good friends still active in there at the moment. And so, yeah, there's...
You have a very interesting insight. Keir Starmer, is he going to go? And effectively, really what I want to ask you, was yesterday a stay of execution, or will he survive this controversy?
I think it was a stay of execution, Greg, because Labour have got several electoral banana skins coming up over the coming weeks. In 2 weeks, we've got the Denton by-election near Manchester, and that is going to be a massive fight. Denton would be a traditionally very safe Labour seat, but there's a lot of disaffection out there about Starmer's leadership. not just within the Labour Party, but nationally. I'm told that he is even more unpopular than Liz Truss, which I personally find hard to believe, but that is the situation out there at the moment. And then you've got, in May, you've got local elections in a number of local authorities, including here in London. And that is also another potential place where Starmer could get into very, very deep trouble. Because at the moment, you've got a kind of a two-end prong attack, if you like, from the Reform Party and the far right, but you also have Jeremy Corbyn's dissident Labour movement trying to sort of eat up a lot of the left-wing vote, along with a resurgent Green Party here in Britain. So Starmer is not going to be facing into an easy time over the coming months. And I'm wondering if the Labour Parliamentary Party have decided to keep Starmer in place until after those elections.
But that obviously must be because they don't have anyone groomed to take over from him, because there would be a logic to try and get a bounce by changing the leadership potentially with all of the upcoming elections, etc., that you referenced.
Well, exactly, Greg. You would think so. But of course, the Labour leadership had stopped Andy Burnham, who would have been the obvious challenger, from standing in the Denton by-election. You also have a number of papabili, if you like, in the background, people like Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary. Streeting had, from the WhatsApps, a fairly close relationship with Peter Mandelson, who's clearly box office poison now in the light of the further revelations of his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. But then you also have Angela Rayner, who'd be very much the darling of a lot of the Labour members. But she has her own challenges in that she's got a tax investigation ongoing, and she's had questions about rental properties and things like that. So even the name of Ed Miliband, blast from the past from 2015, has been mentioned, although I would personally discount any notion of Ed Miliband re-standing to be Labour leader. So at the moment, there doesn't appear to be an obvious challenger, and I suspect that a lot of people are keeping their powder dry until after the elections.
Keir Starmer's kind of being framed as an appointee, tactically, really, to sort of maybe shift the politics of Labour a little bit. That generally he seems to be a nice guy, but that he can't function in his role without his close key advisers, which he no longer has. That's not a very fair assessment of him, is it?
I don't think it is. And in fairness, Keir Starmer has won a thumping majority for Labour. But then my own personal view is that Labour have often tried to sort of oust vote winners. Now, I know that Tony Blair is a very divisive figure, but Tony Blair did win three general elections in a row for Labour, and he was ousted by Gordon Brown, who subsequently lost the 2010 election. And Starmer, you know, does have a certain amount of appeal. He may be unpopular now at the moment, but he's definitely unpopular, I think, amongst majority of Labour activists on the ground. And the problem is where do we get, or who is the likely person to potentially lead Labour into the next general election, which doesn't have to be held, by the way, I think, until 28 or 29. So there is some time to go yet.
Yeah, indeed. So you're of the view, in summary, that he will limp to the local regional elections and perhaps then be on the chopping block shortly thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, what you have to watch out for is that for the Conservatives, who would normally have a fairly solid and loyal vote, a lot of their vote has been nibbled up by the Reform Party. And in fact, in my own local constituency in North London, the Labour candidate, David Pinto-Duszynski, won by a majority of 15 votes. But the Conservative vote was eaten significantly by the Reform Party, who polled several thousand votes in our constituency. So I wouldn't discount anything yet. It would be very interesting to see what the impact Reform have on Conservative vote, but also the impact of the Greens. And I think the Greens are probably a more significant threat to Labour than the Jeremy Corbyn, our party. I don't think they've even got an agreement as to long-term who's going to actually lead that.
Richard, thank you so very much indeed. I really appreciate your time today. That was Richard Logue. Thank you to all of you who commented and messaged in. I will get to those very early in the show tomorrow, but that's where we must leave it for today.